Hello and welcome to New Books in Education. I'm Trevor Matea, one of your hosts on the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Nikhil Goyal about his book, Schools on Trial, How Freedom and Creativity Can Fix Our Educational Malpractice. Nikhil, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I was wondering if we could begin the interview by having you tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I am 20 years old. I graduated from Syosset High School on Long Island in January 2013. And since then, I've been a journalist and education researcher, writing about progressive, democratic, and innovative schools and communities around the country, and also exploring the issues around how children learn, the history of public education, and some of the recent education policies that have been put forth by the Obama administration.
So of all the things you could have done after high school, what made you interested in researching education and writing about that topic?
Yeah, I mean, I've been always somebody who was frustrated in school. I did not find school to be a very interesting and enjoyable experience. I found it to be quite alienating because what I was most interested in learning was not being covered in the curriculum. Teachers didn't really seem to be very interested in exposing me to topics and subjects that I was most passionate about. Namely, politics and social sciences, and things that were going on in the real world. A lot of those things weren't happening at school, and I just started to do research, ask questions about why was school like this, why did the education have to operate this way, and just those kind of beginning questions led me to do research on the education system, reach out to policymakers and education thinkers and parents and students, and try to get a better idea of how the system could be changed for the better. And so I went around the country to schools and communities that I would argue are reimagining and transforming the visions of education, and moving away from the kind of traditional educational model of testing and grades and standardized testing and lectures, to more so an experiential, hands-on, project-based, and much more freer and creative approach to education.
So tell us a little bit more about how you came to write Schools on Trial.
I mean, I've been working on this book for the past couple of years, and what I wanted to do primarily was show the public that there are amazing models and effective models of schooling around the country that actually have been in existence for many, many years, some of them. And so, I mean, the process was quite interesting. I did a lot of traveling. I did a lot of research and did interviews with students and parents and educators and policymakers. I think the two primary goals of the book are as following. One is to kind of expose the major systemic flaws with the education system. And then second, to offer a much more inspiring and progressive blueprint for how we can change schools. And so, those two things. I think the latter is not often discussed in books about education as much so as the former. So I really wanted to offer a balance of the two.
So early on in the book, you describe a day from your own high school experience at Syosset High School in New York.
Right.
You cite countless examples of small ways that you were frustrated by that experience. So there are short breaks between classes. You're interested in nonfiction, but you're not given opportunities to do that. The quizzes are no good. The lab experiments are scripted.
Right.
But still, the book isn't addressing each of these specific grievances. Instead, it's about making more radical changes to our education system. So you're talking about students choosing their own curriculums, governing the schools along with adults, and also
right.
interacting with adults from a much earlier age. So why are these kind of changes, these sweeping changes, so necessary?
Well, I think they're necessary. I mean, so to kind of lay out the problem, I think, and then I could kind of, within that context, I could kind of explain why I think it's so important for these changes to come about. I mean, if you look at the American education system, we have massive numbers of disengagement, student disengagement in schools. Children are incredibly disengaged in their classrooms. And I mean, there's a lot of research, a Gallup poll, looked at this issue, and they found that as a student goes through more years of formal schooling, the levels of student engagement decrease over time. It's a complete downward spiral over those years in school. There's the fact that kids find school to be incredibly boring and alienating. There's massive, massive research on the bullying epidemic in schools. There's a lot of research to show that children's curiosity and creativity decline dramatically as they go through more years of schooling. And then also the fact that I think that kids are just not learning very well in school. They're finding the experience that they go through all these thousands of hours of school over their careers. Yet many kids do not leave school with basic proficiency in reading math, even after spending all that time dedicated to those subjects. And also I think there's the other problems which look at the issues of the fact that kids really have very few freedoms and rights in school. They're really treated more so as people who need to be controlled rather than empowered. So I think there are major problems with the way we look at schools. And so I think the reason why we need to change them is because we're losing generations of kids and losing their, in terms of their curiosity, their imagination, their self-direction that could be actually be used for really useful and important purposes in our society. And I think on top of that, there is a need, I think, and a craving in the public for a different type of education, an education that is much more in line with students' interests and passions rather than the authority figure or the person who's kind of dictating that at a governmental level. And that's often a view that's shared by many teachers as well. I found that teachers are increasingly so very resistant to many of the recent education reforms, maybe standardized testing or pay for performance or kind of the bashing of teachers unions. So I think many stakeholders, not just students and parents, who are slowly realizing that the system absolutely needs to be transformed.
And I think your critique in the book is so powerful because it's grounded in your own experiences in school. And in fact, you actually name where you go to high school and when you attended. And so you're not like listing particular stakeholders like school board members or administrators or teachers, but it's not difficult for anyone who'd be interested in finding who these individuals are who are sort of implicated from your negative experience. Why did you decide to share those specifics rather than referring to your former high school by some certain characteristics or using a pseudonym?
Right. Yeah. And that's actually, I mean, I've noticed that's a common technique by academics. I mean, what they do is that they don't identify the population necessarily or the place in detail what they're studying. They want to add to more generalizable knowledge. I mean, a lot of sociologists talk about they don't want to necessarily say I'm referring to this place or I'm trying to indict this system. It's more so this is a problem that's much larger than this one individual case. But I think as a journalist, and not only as a researcher, I think as a journalist primarily, I think it's an obligation for me to lay out and expose and show and name specifically the problems and the things I saw. And I think it's a more powerful it has a more powerful effect on readers if you do that, because I think it adds a level of authenticity that may not be there if you just say, oh, this is happening at this school and we don't give the actual name. And the other thing is that I think it's important for journalists and writers to hold people in power and hold officials accountable. And so I think there is that level of making sure there's accountability there. And I think that was kind of also my intention to make sure that we hold these people, hold people's feet to the fire. In terms of the educational decisions and policies they enact.
And now, have you heard from anyone from the school since you started writing about education?
I mean, nothing formally, but I'm sure they're not exactly very pleased with many of the things what I'm saying. But there have been teachers in the past who've expressed sympathetic views and agreements with what I'm saying. So I think there are people in not only this is school I went to, but in many other systems who would share similar perspectives on schooling. And I find, I mean, there are the problem is they are very few of them, I would say. But I do think that there are many really amazing educators who realize the problems with the system. But again, they're hamstrung by the fact that they have very little voice or power within how the education system is shaped. So that's why I think we need to have a discussion and have a debate in this country about how we can bring more power and more influence and in terms of the decision making process to educators and students and their communities, as opposed to politicians and corporations.
Mm-hmm. So then who would you say is your target audience for the book?
Well, I mean, I think there are a couple of different people I'd be interested in having this book reach. Obviously, I'd love to get reach of people in the education system. And I mean, people who are involved in schools and in educators and students and parents. I mean, I think there's anybody who's really interested in the topic of education. I think they will have something to glean from the book itself. I mean, and the other thing, my other purpose of the purpose is to challenge people I specifically say at the end of the introduction is that I don't expect most people to agree with every single point I make. I just want them to kind of think and question and rethink some of their assumptions and beliefs about education and schooling. And hopefully that will lead to them beginning to think about these issues more critically. And so I think there is a lot of hopefully I think this will lead to more debate and discussion, at least in the education community.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. In the same way you are specific about your own experiences, you're very careful to tell your audience who has influenced your thinking. And so you list nine individuals right. In particular. Among them are John Holt, Jonathan Kozol, Maria Montessori, A.S. Neal, and you go on. I was wondering if you could tell our audience a little bit about who these individuals are and how you see their ideas as being connected.
Yeah, I mean, so those individuals, I mean, the ones you've named, they have had an extraordinary impact on my educational thinking and philosophy. One of the common criticisms that people will say is, oh, these people are long dead. They're not relevant. I mean, how could you possibly be citing or being influenced by these people? But in reality, if you actually read some of their books, for example, maybe John Holt or Kozol's or Cole's, Kozol's, I mean, many of these people are not dead, but when they were very influential in the 60s and 70s, many of the kind of critiques they had of schooling are incredibly relevant to today. Like you could almost read what they're saying and it would be very transferable to 21st century society. I think they have extraordinary relevance to the way we look at problems in education today. I think those writers, many of them did come about in the 1960s and 70s, and they were very influential during something called the free school movement, especially Kozol, Holt, and Goodman, and Cole, and so I think there is this kind of revival of some of these ideas, and I hope to bring that about through my writing and to show people that these ideas are not crazy. I mean, they were hashed out and they were talked about very widely in just about 50 years ago. So hopefully, I think this will lead to some kind of a greater interest in those writers.
What do you think happened? So I'm familiar with some of these authors myself, and their arguments were very much part of the mainstream in the 60s and 70s. And I don't hear other people talking about these individuals or their ideas anymore. And so why do you think that might be?
Yeah, it's a really good question because it's one that I've been thinking about quite recently, over the past couple of years. And so I think, so if you look at the history of the free school movement in the 1960s, it was largely, I would say the peak of the free school movement, as many historians would say, was around 1968 to 1972. So it coincided with the massive student protests and acts of civil disobedience against the war, Vietnam War. And around this time, you had many, many books that by these writers that we mentioned come out. And they were extremely influential. I mean, one of the major writers was A.S. Neal, who wrote the book Summer Hill in 1960. And that sold millions of copies, like hundreds and hundreds of college classes adopted that book in their syllabi. So it was very, very influential. And so I think what happened was a few things. One, after the Vietnam War, once that war ended, it crushed a lot of it made a lot of the protests and activism and mobilization that was very prominent over the past decade decrease dramatically. There wasn't this kind of one target that people could latch onto to criticize. And so and education was very similar in that way, in that one of the critiques that people made was the education system is not only just producing people who are docile consumers, they're producing people who are going to be fitting into and functioning in the war machine. So once that machine was obliterated, or at least it had lost its power over time, that had an effect. But I think the other part to this was that the free school movement did not have as many resources that were necessary to help it continue after the peak of 1968 to 1972. I think today you're seeing a revival in many of these ideas because of the fact that public education has been basically gutted by corporate education reforms. And there's an interest in seeing a different education system that moves away from these various reforms.
So you don't think it's just that, most people want to return to a public school system, before No Child Left Behind, without so many standardized tests. But because of these changes, people are now more open to a completely different model in a way they may not have been 10 or 15 years ago.
Right. It's that old saying, like it's got to get a lot worse until it gets better. I think because the system has gone so much worse. I'm not saying it was. And a lot of people romanticize it before them, but I'm just saying it has gone quite bad in the past decade in terms of school closures, the decline of teachers' unions, the fact that teacher pay and morale has plummeted. Those things are terrible, terrible realities. And so I think they're in that kind of landscape. There is a mobilization and renewed interest in these alternative educational models, which is I think it's just quite interesting to see that because I'm very amazed that that people are picking up Neal and Holt and Kozel and Cole that I've noticed particularly more so in recent years that I think has not been the case between 1980 to 2000. So it did take the system to get a lot. To exacerbate for people to begin to think, oh, this system needs to actually be completely transformed. I don't think we're fully there yet, but I do think that people are beginning to think deeply about some of these issues and writers and ideas.
So you've talked a little bit about the free school movement. I was wondering if you can share some of the key attributes of free schools and what makes them different from both traditional schools and other progressive schools?
Yeah, sure. So to give a little context, the free school movement, as I mentioned, it was very prominent in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And the free school movement was, the people who were behind it were advocating for a completely revolutionized view of education. So education that would not be to produce people who are docile, compliant, workers, but rather free thinking, curious, creative, imaginative, and self-directed human beings. That there's a very, very different view of what education systems should produce. And actually, I would argue it goes against the kind of fundamental tenets of capitalism and the overall economic system. So they were radical thinkers. They were really bold, progressive thinkers. And they set up hundreds of these free schools around the country, basically places where there were no grades. There were no tests. There was democratic structures in place, so students and teachers could vote and have ownership over the learning process. And there was self-directed learning, project-based learning. the fact that the community should not be divorced from the classroom. They should be deeply ingrained and connected with one another. So free schools, there were hundreds of these in that time period of the 60s and 70s. They did decrease the number quite a bit. But today, I would say there are a couple hundred of them still in existence around the country. And even I think the number is growing, even though they may not necessarily be called free schools. One of the schools I talk about in the book is the Brooklyn Free School. And the Brooklyn Free School was started, I think, in the early 2000s, I think 2004. And it was the first free school to open in the city in I think, over three decades. So this was a new development. And the free schools, I think the model hasn't changed dramatically since the 60s and 70s. I mean, they're very much so based on the principles of trust and freedom, self-directed learning, reciprocal relationships between students and teachers, democratic governance. I mean, those kinds of principles, I think, have largely remained the same. But I do think that some free schools have fortunately become more diverse and economically responsive to the needs of working parents. I mean, the Brooklyn Free School is a perfect example in that they have sliding scale tuition, and there's a percentage of students who don't pay anything. So, and I think that's one of the big critiques of the free schools back in the 60s and 70s was the lack of diversity. They were largely very white, upper or middle to upper middle class people and families who were participating in this movement. And Kozol is one of the people, Jonathan Kozol was one of the people who slammed the movement for not being accessible to poor black and brown and children, arguably the people who need this kind of education the most. So yeah, fortunately, I think there is more awareness around the issues of equity and diversity. And I encourage people in the free school movement and as well as in the progressive education movement in general to take hard looks at how we can bring more equity into our schools and reach the most vulnerable and disadvantaged children in our society. Because as I mentioned, these are the people who are in the most regimented, disciplined schools, the schools where they have no freedom or play and very few resources. They need the democratic free schooling the most.
Now, are you generally sympathetic to all of the school models to some degree within alternative education? Are there certain models that you all have reservations about in the same way you do our current model for public education?
Yeah, I mean, so I've never, full disclaimer, I've never visited a Waldorf school, but from what I've read and observed and heard talk from people, I do have some reservations and concerns about some of their educational approaches and in terms of the kind of spirituality aspect of the school, to the fact that technology is banned for a certain number of years at the school. So yeah, I think there are some pedagogical as well as kind of systemic issues with Waldorf schools that I would be interested in looking at further. But again, I've not visited those schools. This is kind of just from my understanding. But yeah, I like I mentioned, I think I obviously have criticisms of the free school movement. And most of my criticisms really do lie within the issues around diversity and equity, because sadly, many of these alternative schools are not found in the communities that need them most. But at the same time, there is, I mean, in New York State, for example, there's a network of schools called the New York Standard Performance Standards Consortium, which is a group of public progressive schools that offer portfolio-based assessment, project-based learning, much smaller class sizes, and the students who do attend these schools tend to be students who are of color, disadvantaged, maybe special education students, or just students who have been disengaged from traditional schooling. And the outcomes show that they have higher graduation rates, lower dropout rates, and overall a higher student engagement than their comparable traditional public schools. So I think that is one area to be hopeful for. But I think more free schools should be cognizant of the landscape that we are living in and more aware of issues around diversity.
You write extensively around about a school called Brightworks in San Francisco. And when you're interviewing Brightworks founder Gaver Tully, he says that parents in San Francisco, however much they don't want to send their children to the traditional schools, or I guess the public schools in that city, they're also not necessarily interested in free schools. I was wondering, do you agree with his assessment?
It's a very interesting point, and it's something that I want to explore further, because it's actually a topic I'm hoping to write about and spend some time on in the next couple of years. So it's a very good, very interesting point you made, that parents of color or immigrant parents are not particularly interested in sending their kids to progressive school. So here's what I would say is that there has been quite a bit of criticism of progressive education from people, from African-American and I think some Hispanic writers. One of them is an African-American educator named Lisa Delpit, who's basically argued that the progressive education, or she calls liberal education, cannot deliver the kind of codes of power and the skills, the basic skills that are necessary for poor kids of color in order for them to succeed in the global economy, that they need the kind of drill and kill basic skill instruction in order to compete and do well in our world today. She basically says that progressive education cannot deliver those skills. It's only for the kids who are within what she calls the culture of power, who have parents who read to them, who have parents who are well educated and well resourced. So I think it's quite I take issues with that assessment, particularly because as I mentioned, this consortium network of progressive schools. I mean, these are schools that are largely inclusive of African American Latino kids. Their populations are have large majorities of these students, and they do extremely well in a progressive education environment. And it's also my argument that that the kind of drill and kill basic skill instruction, or this kind of rote learning instruction, has actually, I mean, it has not been effective for poor kids and kids of color. It's actually that kind of education is deadening. It's actually the one type of education that has led many kids to drop out and become alienated from school. I don't understand the argument that it will that this type of that the same old type of education is going to be effective and good for these kids. Again, it's an issue I want to look at further. There are schools in communities of color, such as El Centro del Estudiantes in the Kensington neighborhood in Philadelphia, that I spent some time at. So I hope to explore this issue in the future. And the other point I want to make is that sometimes I think one of the reasons why poor parents of color might be a little bit hesitant to send their kids to a progressive school is that progressive schools tend to be a little bit more isolated and not as much so have connections to the larger community. And I think that's a flaw. It's not a general flaw. I think it does happen in some communities that I think that might lead parents to not want to be attracted to a school like that.
You've mentioned this consortium of progressive schools in New York, and many of those schools being in communities where there are lots of students of color, lots of low-income students. How are these schools who say that they work for all kinds of students? How do they typically measure their success? Do they use standardized test scores or something else?
Yeah, so the consortium network, to give a little background, it was started, I think, 2 decades ago. I'm on a board of an organization called Fair Test with the founder, Ann Cook, the co-founder. She founded the school called Urban Academy as part of the consortium network in New York City. And so the students in consortium schools, basically in New York State, you have to take a number of regents exams in order to graduate. The consortium schools have gotten an exemption from that, in that they've only have to give the English regents, and instead of the other regents exams, the students have to submit a portfolio of, for example, a science experiment, a math paper, a research project, a social studies paper, so things like that that demonstrate their knowledge in a certain subject. And so they've gone away from the metrics of standardized tests and towards portfolio based assessment. And they also, I believe they look at issues, of metrics of student engagement, and graduation rates. And like I said, they do have higher graduation rates than the comparable traditional public schools.
Getting back to Brightworks for a moment there. So this is a school in San Francisco where students spend the vast majority of their time. They're engaged in long-term projects, or they have an opportunity to engage in free play. And I was wondering, you know, if some parents are enrolling their children in that school and also sending their kids to after-school tutoring programs, or sort of informally instructing their kids at home and in areas where they feel comfortable, like the rote math, for example, or spelling, things like that. Are they providing some traditional aspects of education that they think might be missing at Brightworks? Could these kids who are doing well there not just be doing well because they go to an alternative school like this, but they're getting that kind of education at school, but they're getting a more traditional school experience from their parents at home? Do you sense that this is common among parents who are sending their children to alternative schools?
Right. Yeah, that's a very, very important question. And as far as I can tell, at Brightworks, that is not the case. I do not know. I don't believe parents are giving their kids extra like tutoring or specific kind of instruction at home. But obviously, I think the school does provide and successfully has helped kids gain the reading, basic reading and math skills and many other areas. The larger issue I think you're kind of alluding to, and I think it's an important one, is around whether these kids are doing well at Brightworks or just a progressive school because they're getting the reading, they're being read to at home, or they have the kind of books and resources at home. And I think obviously that's going to give them a leg up than a kid who has none of that at home. This is another kind of goes to another question and another topic, which is that I could talk about this a little bit, but like the question is that does school actually matter very much if you are a kid who has affluent parents? Like, does school really matter that much? And the research in terms of the social science, what it shows is that it really doesn't matter very much, because in terms of rising levels of income inequality and wealth inequality, the gap between rich and poor, the fact that the decreasing levels of social mobility in this country, it really doesn't matter. If a rich kid, if you go to a poor school or a really high ranking school, it really doesn't matter, because your future, your economic future, is really going to be dependent upon the income of your parents. I think my point really in terms of the education and pedagogical approach to this is that a more progressive education may not necessarily lead to better economic outcomes, but it can lead to human beings who are more curious and self-directed and free thinking and people who are democratic citizens. Mm-hmm. I think those types of attributes, if we want that to happen in our society, we should be advocating for a more progressive education, but we should not somehow believe that a more progressive education system is going to make our economic systems more fair and equitable. It's not, because it arguably what social scientists have known for decades is that the education system is simply reinforcing and reproducing the existing social order and economic structures. There are obviously many stories of people who do rise out of poverty and decrepit conditions into middle class and upper class life. But those are the exceptions. And the system, as we know it today, does not produce a widespread lifting of all boats. It does not lead to massive wealth redistribution through the education system. That those changes are desired through the economic system. So I think that we should not, there's this kind of notion that the best tool to fight poverty is education. And in reality, it's not. The best tool to fight poverty is wealth distribution. It's giving money to poor people. It's giving more resources to people in those disadvantaged situations. And so I think education, yes, I'm all in favor of educating our populations, but it should not be the major strategy for how we achieve social and economic justice.
So while you think increasing economic mobility is a worthwhile goal, you don't see public schools as the best vehicle for that. You see public schools as a vehicle to promote free thinking, happy individuals who are more likely to participate in our democratic system.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's a very different purpose of education that deviates from the original purpose, which back in the early in the mid 1800s. So I mean, a lot of people do share this vision and goal for educations, but it's something that I think is increasingly common amongst education thinkers. How do we? I think the big question is, what are the purposes of schooling? Is it to warehouse kids? Is it to create a system of social control, or is it to create a system of empowerment and curiosity and self-direction? So those are very stark contrasts between the two ideologies.
If we could stay on that idea for a moment, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about your vision for education and public education in general. So what do you think is the primary purpose of becoming educated, and what's the purpose of public education?
Yeah, so like I said, I think the primary purpose of a mass education system is to produce a population of people who are free thinking, curious, decision makers, problem solvers, not just people who can take tests very well and passively follow directions and submit to authority. Like it's a very different system. And I would argue that the primary purposes of schools today is as following. Like I mentioned, one of them is the warehousing of children. The original purpose was always to get the kids off the streets, out of the factories, and get them into a school building, and in some place that they could be out of the sight of employers and parents for the day, and be under the control of some supervision. And the second purpose I would say is to teach them to fit into our capitalistic and consumer-based economy. And so the one of the arguments that has been brought up by kind of radical education thinkers, and even though I'm not a Marxist or a socialist, I think there are some really legitimate assessments that Marxists and socialists have made about our education system, particularly two people, Samuel Bowles and Herbert Gintis, who wrote the book Schooling in Capitalist America. And they argue, based on a lot of data and research, that the kind of traits that schools prize are directly correlating to the traits that employers prize, which are punctuality, obedience, following directions, making sure that you stay on task, and among other things. So there's a very strong correspondence principle, as these two social scientists say. So I think there's a lot of legitimate, there's a lot of right there. And I think we need to move away from that kind of system of social control. And I think a public education system should be adequately funded. It should be moved away from the property tax model to a system that is based much more equitably adequately funded. Because if you've seen in the recent weeks in cities like Detroit and Chicago and Philadelphia, the schools are crumbling. The schools are in decrepit conditions. There's not enough books, paper, toilet paper. The teachers are underpaid. The schools there's mold growing in the schools. There are rats and mice running around the hallways. I mean, these are not habitable, humane places for learning. And these schools need to be fully renovated and adequately funded, and they're being abandoned by our society today.
In the book, you do give a lengthy explanation about the origins of our public schools and how they're modeled after a Prussian model of schools from the 1800s. And so some of our listeners may be familiar with the new documentary film Most Likely to Succeed, or Lauren Powell Jobs' call to redesign American high schools, which she had last fall. But these people also draw upon this history for their critique. But I think it's safe to say that your policy goals are a greater departure from the model that we have now than theirs are. So I was wondering if you could explain that Prussian school model, how it's come to influence our country's schools, and why it's so undesirable.
I actually did some research for Most Likely to Succeed, so I'm a big fan of the documentary. I do also support much of what Laureen Powell Jobs has been advocating around redesigning schools. So I think there's a lot of uplifting and positive developments that have been happening recently. On the issue of the Prussian education system, that is very much discussed in Most Likely to Succeed. The Prussian education system is what it has directly influenced our schools from the beginning. You had the father of American education, Horace Mann, going to Prussia, visiting schools, observing classrooms, and bringing back his findings to America and showing that if you want to create a compliant population, a population that would submit to authority, not cause trouble, fit into the social order, the Prussian education system is your best bet. And it was not just Horace Mann. There were many other education thinkers who visited Prussia. And I believe many of them also did get their PhDs over there. So there is a lot of influence in that system. And the Prussian system, which is essentially a command and control model, has directly influenced the American system. And one of the big critics of the Prussian education system, at least during the time when it was being proposed as the model for American education, was a man named Orestes Bronson, who was basically saying that America cannot resemble despotic Prussia. That if in this country we look to the government looks to the people for guidance rather than the people looking for the government for guidance as they do in Prussia. So the model is very different and should not be resembled in our country. So there was quite a bit of backlash to that, the Prussian model. And I think that the model has largely remained largely remained with us since the mid 1800s. Michael Katz, who was a late historian who recently died, I think last year, had said that by the year 1888, most of the fundamental principles and structures that we see in American education system, in our American education system today, were created by that time. So that's when the system was firmly in place and has largely operated in the same stance ever since.
I think that one thing that Prussian model or the factory model has going for it is that it's scalable.
Right, it's very efficient. It's an incredibly efficient model, and it's understandable why industrialists of that era looked to that system for guidance and just how we can model ourselves after them, because it worked extremely, extremely well in terms of producing a subservient military, a population. So the system did work in its best interests.
And it's scalable too.
Right.
So I wonder, is there a way for us to like mass produce creative thinking? Like, can free schools exist successfully if there are, you know, tens of thousands of them? If everyone's neighborhood public school is replaced by a Sudbury school, like, can that work? Could you scale up the kind of schooling that you want? And what are the challenges associated with that kind of change?
Yeah, it's a good question. To give a little context, there are thousands of Montessori schools, thousands of Waldorf schools, thousands of the schools that call themselves progressive, and then you have hundreds of free, democratic, and Sudbury schools around the country. So, I mean, it's not a small movement. I think it is a quite growing and large movement, but at the same time, you do have the issue of scale is an important concern. And I do think that we should – the idea of scale, I think – is very much so wedded to the industrial and McDonald's version of scale in terms of the industrial mass-produced education system. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to think of scale in terms of – we have a few common principles in terms of the way we view learning and schooling. And then let – that can be the driving force, but then let the communities themselves decide how best to implement and adopt those principles. And I think that's a more grassroots effort. And I think that's the only way it can come about. Obviously, I think government can play a role, and there can be some top-down measures. But at the end of the day, there needs to be a much more bottom-up transformation and grassroots movement to support these ideas and create a system of scale.
In the book, when you're talking about the current what's happening right now in education reform, you talk about the significance of President Obama's choice to appoint former Superintendent of Chicago Public Schools, Arne Duncan, as his Secretary of Education. How might our public schools look different today if the president had instead appointed someone else, such as Stanford professor Linda Darling Hammond?
Yeah, the Obama era in terms of education has been a complete and utter disaster, in my opinion. And that opinion is shared by most educators, I would say. Linda Darling Hammond is a great thinker. I think she's done a lot of really, really good work. Her view of education is starkly in contrast to the Duncan Obama vision, which is Arne Duncan, who was superintendent or CEO of Chicago Public Schools, somebody who's adopted a more corporate education reform view of school closures, pay for performance, standardized testing, weakening teachers' unions, among other things, more charter schools. And that's a very, very different view, I think. And I think what you have seen is an education system that would have moved away from its obsession with test scores and grades and performance, and moved towards more of a humanistic education system under somebody like Linda Darling Hammond. But we'll have to see what happens in the next cycle. But I very, very disappointed in what's happened over the past 8 years.
You acknowledge the existence of credentialism, or this need to check off a box so that you can pursue your professional goals in the society that we live in. And so while you might not need formal education to learn, at some point you'll likely need it so that you have something to put on your resume. And of course, the effect is amplified if you're attending a school that's perceived as being particularly selective. And so my question for you is, if you were ultimately responsible for your own education, regardless of where you go to school, and so that college is ultimately about networking and signaling to your future employers that, you know, you are a smart and ambitious person, why did you decide not to attend an Ivy League institution when, you know, you are someone who's being brought to speak on these campuses and you clearly have the credentials to attend? Is there a reason why you're not drawn to one of these institutions for your own education?
Yeah, no, I mean, I did definitely consider it. I think there is a lot of problems with that mode of education that has been well documented in recent years. For example, there was a book that came out last year, I think 2 years ago, called Excellent Sheep, examining some of the problems with elite education and how it's producing people who are timid and passive and obedient and not very much so critical thinkers. So I think there are major, major problems with that system. In terms of the issue of credentialism, I hope this obsession with credentials is weakening. And we are moving towards a system that allows people who don't have these credentials to be viewed as intelligent and important and valuable. Because when we have a system that is based so heavily on credentials, it is a very unequal system that will not allow some people to have equal opportunities as others.
I'm wondering if you could share a little bit with us about your final chapter in the book, where you sort of outline your vision for what schools of the future, or maybe I shouldn't say schools, but education, right, public education could look like in our country. Could you kind of lay that out for us? What could we be doing differently? What would that look like practically?
Yeah. In simplest terms, I would say the three major things I'm advocating for are the humanization of schools, the democratization of schools, and the restructuring of them. Those are the three major components, I would say. And really the idea of visioning the city and community as the school itself. So why shouldn't we be able to let children learn, live and learn in the real world and use community centers and makerspaces and libraries, athletic centers, apprenticeships, internships, and other opportunities for them to engage and learn in, as opposed to sitting in a school building where they have very little relevance and connection to the real world. How about we let them become lifelong learners and work aside adults? There's a great quote by John Holt who said that the most proper place for children to be in is in the mainstream of adult life. So I do think that I agree with that. I think it's something that adults and children should be constantly in collaboration and engagement with. And I think they will learn from each other a lot more if we do so. And so hopefully I'm a big proponent of expanding the funds for public education and allowing cities and communities to become the incubators of lifelong learning and collaboration, because those can really transform not only children's lives but our society at large.
Well, Nikhil, we've taken up a lot of your time, so I'll just ask you one more question, and that's what are you working on now?
Well, I'm looking I touched on this a little bit earlier. I'm looking at the issue of dropouts and progressive education and communities of color and progressive education in terms of their effectiveness with disengaged youth. So I'm hoping to examine this in particular at a couple of schools in the next couple of years.
That sounds like a great follow-up to this book. Nikhil, I want to thank you for being on our show today. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for having me and really appreciate your questions.